The principles of civility are the principles that modulate, temper our self-love and the worst excesses of our selfishness and help us consider the needs of others alongside of ourselves. They're remarkably timeless. People have independently come to similar assessments about what works when it comes to human flourishing and genuine human relationship and cooperation and collaboration and what doesn't. And that is remarkable and fascinating to me. Like, I start my chapter 2 with the oldest book in the world, which is a civility book given to us from ancient Egypt, 2350 BC. And a lot of these maxims from Tahotep could appear in a Judith Martin Miss Manners column today in the Washington Post. They're just remarkably timeless conventional wisdom about how to do life together.
And now, The Good Fight with Yasha Monk.
My name is Sam Kahn. I'm an associate editor of Persuasion. I just published a piece in Persuasion called A Mid-August Fever Dream. It's a new genre for me, and really for Persuasion, political fiction. I wanted to explore in depth what everybody has been talking about, what would happen if Biden dropped out. It seemed for a while that this was the really important question of the 2024 election, but I hadn't seen a lot on the mechanics of what that might look like. And when I was working on the piece, I understood why. It was startlingly hard to get a clear picture of it. The rules for a brokered convention and nominating process are really obscure. But the point was that it was possible. Biden could step down. An exciting Democratic candidate could emerge and win. At this point, I don't think it'll happen, but it's fun to have a forum like this to explore the possibility. I hope you read the piece. Thanks.
Sam Kahn's article, A Mid-August Fever Dream, was published by Persuasion. To learn more about the community we're building at Persuasion, and to get similar articles directly into your inbox, head to www.persuasion.community.
Alexandra Hudson is the founder of Civic Renaissance and an adjunct professor at the Indiana University Lilly School of Philanthropy. She's also the author of The Soul of Civility, Timeless Principles to Heal Society and Ourselves. We had a really interesting conversation about what civility actually means, how it's different from politeness and manners books, and why it is that these long-standing values and virtues can actually help us have a more productive civic conversation. Alexandra Hudson, welcome to the podcast.
Yasha, thrilled to be here.
So you wrote a timeless book that's also an unfashionable book, which is A Defense of Civility. Why is it that in this political moment you think we need civility, that civility would do something good for our politics or our society or perhaps both?
I think that civility is this deeply underrated idea and virtue. Everyone thinks that they know exactly what it is and has very strong opinions on it. They either want more of it and think it's the antidote, the panacea to revive our comity and harmony in public life, or they think it's the enemy of justice and equality and equity and want less of it. They want to, you know, burn it all down. But I argue that both of these contentions actually miss what true civility is. And true civility, properly understood, is actually indispensable to a free and flourishing society, especially in a democracy like our own. And in a nutshell, civility is the art of human flourishing. It is the bare minimum of respect that we are owed and owe to others by virtue of our shared humanity and common dignity. And it is different from mere politeness. It is not just, you know, papering over difference, not just etiquette, not just niceness. It is respecting someone, loving someone enough to tell a hard truth, engaging in robust debate, making someone uncomfortable. I'm writing an essay for Time magazine right now, and I've spent some time this week with Emily Post's 1922 Etiquette, this tome, this like 800-page tome on manners. And it actually, you know, she wrote it for kind of her own elite sort of upper crust New York society to be this definitive work in the post-war era to help people navigate life together across difference. And it ended up being this book that was actually widely used by immigrants to kind of acclimate to new life in America, kind of the norms and mores of the dominant culture. But what's interesting, she has this line that stood out to me. She said, all of etiquette can be basically summed down to one line, and like not making other people feel uncomfortable. And I thought that was so interesting because actually life together requires discomfort sometimes. And discomfort with others is endemic to life, but it also requires that we seek out discomfort and be willing to have uncomfortable conversations. That's actually part of human flourishing. We can't just run away from that.
Wonderful. So that's a great intro into the topic. Let's start with the sort of leftist critique of this, right? So the leftist critique of civility is to say, look, we are fighting for really important principles. There's dangerous politicians who want to take our rights away. We have suffered discrimination and exclusion. And now you're asking us to be polite to the people who have oppressed us, to the people who have excluded us, right? Like, this is a kind of procedural value which actually helps to perpetuate the injustices and the forms of discrimination that truly characterize our society. That roughly, I think, is my best attempt to ventriloquate that position. What's your response to that? Why is it that civility is a value in a democratic society, even in the face of injustice?
A lot of the critiques of civility should actually be redirected towards politeness. And that's a core argument of my book, that there is this essential distinction between civility and politeness. And you're right. A common argument we hear from the left is that, you know, civility, manners, politeness, that they are these tools of the patriarchy. They're tools of the powerful to keep the powerless and to keep the oppressed oppressed. And that's why we need less of those things in public life in order to pursue more justice and equity in our world. And I argue that that contingent, that that argument actually conflates two important ideas that ought to be disentangled, civility and politeness. I argue that, again, politeness is etiquette, it's manners, it's technique, it's external. And that sort of tone policing, that focus on external compliance with norms and protocol and propriety, that has been a tool of oppressing and silencing discussion and oppressing minorities and dissenting voices. But that civility, again, this disposition of the heart, different than just mere superficial compliance with etiquette, norms, protocols, that civility, the disposition of the heart that truly respects others, that sees it as worthwhile speaking truth to power and risking offending people for a greater good. And I have a whole chapter in my book on civil disobedience, that sometimes speaking truth to power, sometimes taking action in the form of protests, of sit-ins, letter writing campaigns. Like I feature abolitionists from William Lloyd Garrison to Frederick Douglass to Henry David Thoreau, Gandhi, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., from other figures in the civil rights movement, to show how they actually employed the disposition of civility to inform what they did and how they went about speaking truth to power. It can be this tool for us today.
So help me understand those distinctions, right? So I have a sense of what politeness is. Of course, what is polite is going to differ from time to time and certainly from cultural context to cultural context. But I certainly understand what in the United States in 2024 might be considered polite. I can see what it would mean to reject any norms of politeness or civility, right? To say that political activists just speak the truth and fight with any means necessary, no matter the circumstances, because their goal, their political objective is so important that the means justify, that those ends justify the means. What is that middle category? So what does it mean to have a concept of civility which says sometimes you can be impolite, sometimes you can break the norms of the Senate, the norms of some political institutions, the norms of a city council, if that's what it takes to fight for a righteous cause. But presumably there are side constraints on it, right? It is not to say do whatever you want if your cause is just, because otherwise that would not be civility either. So help us understand that middle ground between mere politeness and anything goes.
You're absolutely right. And I'm very influenced by and invoke Dr. King a lot in his letter from Birmingham Jail. He offers us a litmus test for how to know when it is appropriate to deviate from, you know, politeness in order to pursue a greater good. He says, you know, how do we tell the difference, for example, between a just or unjust positive law? He says, a just law is one that uplifts human personality and affirms human dignity, and an unjust law corrodes human personality. It degrades personhood and human dignity. And I realize that the same is true with our social norms. And that is a good litmus test to help us think about when is it appropriate to deviate from either positive law or informal social norms and informal, mores and protocols. And this is exactly, you know, civility, as I define it and explore it throughout my book, it informed Dr. King's view of nonviolent peaceful resistance. He said he anyone who wanted to be part of his movement had to undergo this process of purification, he called. And purification was essentially cultivating how I describe the disposition of civility, and a fundamental esteem, respect, love for one's fellow citizens, people who held deeply bigoted, evil, abhorrent views, white supremacist, racist views. And that love and respect actually informed and compelled their action, their protest. It's saying, I respect you enough to confront you with the reality that you have an inaccurate view of the world. And I'm going to take action to show you that. But at the same time, to your question, at the same time that civility demanded action, it also took certain action off the table. For example, Dr. King was not a proponent of sort of the instrumentalist view of justice that you were just alluding to, where the ends justifies the means. He never allowed those, his supporters, to engage in viciousness, ad hominem attack, violence, destruction of property, because he, Gandhi, and others, other thoughtful proponents of nonviolent, peaceful resistance before him knew that sort of consequentialism, the ends justifying the means, undermined their whole project. Gandhi has this great line. I'm paraphrasing, but he says, you know, people are prone to say that the means don't matter, right? We have to be willing to do anything in order to win. And our just ends are so just, we have to be prepared, you know, to take the gloves off and do anything. And Gandhi says, no, no, no. Means, in fact, are everything. They knew, and like the abolitionists before knew them, and other thoughtful people before them who engaged in, you know, fight against racism and slavery and other forms of injustice and inequality knew that in their pursuit of equal respect of personhood under the law and equal respect for human dignity and recognition, that they could not undermine the personhood and human dignity of some people along the way. They just saw that inherent tension.
So I agree with most of what you just said there, but I think I'm still struggling to quite put my finger on what that middle category of civility would be. So perhaps let's take a very concrete example, right? Let's imagine that you are part of a family gathering, the famous, you know, Thanksgiving dinner, it could be something else, right? And you're dealing with the proverbial racist uncle, right? Somebody in your family who you might like and love, who you might have a real affection for, but whose political views you find to be genuinely abhorrent. And it's not the politeness, right? The politeness is you try to avoid talking about politics and ask about how his kids are doing and pass him the turkey. I understand the kind of fighting spirit. Uncle Joe, I love you, but you are a terrible human being and I'm not going to eat dinner with you. It's like, right? I mean, I don't know why it's Uncle Joe. This is not meant to be a reference to Joe Biden.
Everyone has an Uncle Joe.
I don't. My uncles all have, you know, Polish, Eastern European or Jewish or Eastern European Jewish names. So Joe is not a family name in my case. But what's the middle category, right? Like, what is it to have a conversation where you express that disagreement, where hopefully you might help somebody see a different point of view, but it remains within the realm of civility? What does that mean in concrete terms?
It's such a great question. This is the whole purpose and, you know, my theory of civility in the book, that many people want to focus on rules. They want maxims. They want black and white rules of what to do and when. I mean, this is what Emily Post does in 800-900 pages. Like, she gives you a litany, a myriad, endless examples of real concrete human experiences, and she gives you her theory of exactly the appropriate thing to do in that circumstance. And my argument is actually like, no, you know, human life is actually way too complex to be essentialized and reduced to a certain set of maxims and rules that apply in all times and places, and that we need instead discretion, prudence, the disposition of civility that respects others and knows how to deploy that respect appropriate to the context. So, for example, to your point about Uncle Joe or our racist, you know, relative at the dinner table that has a unconventional or distasteful belief that we disagree with, I could actually see it going both ways. On one hand, I have a whole chapter in my book dedicated to why we have allowed politics to take over every aspect of our lives in a very detrimental way. And we have allowed politics to invade our dinner tables.
Right. One source could simply be, I'm not going to persuade this person. I'm not going to change their mind. I'm just going to sit with a discomfort and have dinner with them and avoid politics.
And find areas of agreement and shared love. Because it feels like we too often lead with the hot button topics, the culture war issues. Like, that's that. Like, we wear those on our sleeves, and that just, like, it sows division wherever we go, and that's bad for our souls and bad for democracy as well. If we're only doing having the hard debates and conversations without any break from it, that's without any reprieve to, like, you know, come around shared experiences, shared relationships, shared, you know, holidays. You know, my argument in the final chapter of my book is that there are more important things than politics that we need need to celebrate and affirm. And too often people have made politics kind of a quasi-religion, an idol in their lives. That's the most important thing. That's why they lead with it. And they want to know, you know, where are you on this issue? And that's how they view everything about you, right? And they, whether you're worth being in their lives, even if you're a long-term friend or a family member. And that's, so on one hand, I would definitely say that it's appropriate sometimes to be like, you know what, you want to bring up this controversial topic, I'm going to diffuse it and pivot, diffuse and pivot. I could also see it going, you know, maybe there is a point of disagreement and some time has passed and some of the friendship has and relationship and love and affection, the social capital has like been rebuilt. And maybe this is a good opportunity to rehash a conversation about a very hot button, you know, controversial topic. Because the reality is we're too often having these conversations with people without that basic love, affection, familiarity, and trust. And that, you know, we're going from 0 to 60, assuming the absolute worst and extrapolating, you know, taking their view on one issue, Donald Trump, the vaccine, like whatever it is, and extrapolating everything we think we know, everything there is to know about this person. And in fact, you know, friendship, family relationships, those have potentially are the most fruitful opportunities to have productive conversations across difference, because in theory, you have that trust, you have that affection, you're not going to be as inclined to assume the worst and be uncharitable towards others. So anyway, this is the whole argument in my book, that human life is far too complex to be essentialized to some static rules of politeness, that we need, in fact, a framework. And I think the disposition of civility gives us that framework. What is respecting someone in this context call for? And what is loving this person in this specific context call for? And I hope that my book empowers people to deploy that wisdom appropriate to the moment.
I get that it's not going to be a set of static rules. I get that it's not going to be, you know, pass the salt, then do this, then do that, right? But even then, I guess I want to understand conceptually what that framework is or how it is that it differs from the other extremes, right? So what is it to have a robust disagreement with a fellow citizen, with a compatriot, or with a family member, with a close friend, and yet to interact with them, to combine two competing maxims, one of which is that you respect this human being in front of you, who you have reason to see as somebody to whom you owe some duty of respect and some duty of care, thin for perhaps substantial if they're just a fellow citizen, you know, thicker and more important if they're a close friend or a family member. But at the same time, presumably, you do have this commitment to political values, to a political ideal, and you do think that they're in the process of making a political error, of advocating for a candidate policy that you think is going to be disastrous for your country, or of tolerating some kind of injustice, right? And so that's where the tension comes from. You think you owe it to your country or to the world to pursue this important political goal, what you see as a political, important political goal. And at the same time, you want to do it in such a way that respects the actual human being in front of you, recognizing that just because they held a view with which you disagree, that doesn't mean that they don't have, but they're not worthy of some form of respect, but they're not worthy of decent treatment. So even if you're not going to give me sort of a set of hard rules for how to navigate that conflict, is it just framing it in this way? Like what is the framework? What are the maxims that I should go into a situation like that with in order to have sort of orientation as to what to do and what not to do?
Well, I'll tell you a story that is maybe apocryphal and has been told with different female protagonists, but the essence of the story stays the same. It goes like this. When Queen Victoria, you know, the proprietor of all things, you know, arcane Victorian etiquette, right? This era defined by very elaborate systems of protocol, ritual, you know, the inventor of the fish knife that was a thing and maybe still is a thing in certain parts of the world. She has the Queen of Persia to her home for a state dinner. And everyone sits down to eat and the room is aghast when the Queen of Persia does the unthinkable. She takes the bowl in front of her, intended to wash her hands with, and tips it to her lips and drinks it like soup. This, you know, massive faux pas. And the room is silent and stares at Queen Victoria. What is she going to do? What does she do? She takes the bowl and tips it to her lips and drinks it like soup, just as her guest had done. Why? Why did she break this very basic, you know, convention that she herself had instituted? To make, for the sake of community, for the sake of making her guest feel welcome and comfortable, for the sake of social trust and friendship and relationship, which was the purpose of the entire dinner, after all. And, you know, in my book, I unpack other examples of how, you know, the spirit of civility can pervade our lives, our social lives, like what a snob might do at a dinner party when they see someone making a faux pas, they might relish that they know the rules And they're part of the in-group, this, you know, secret cabal that read Emily Post and others like her and is familiar with the rituals, you know, and use that as a tool of division, as the rules of politeness often have been, defining in-group, out-group, you know, and segregating classes not just between cultures, but within a society. But a civil person, instead of, you know, silently judging the person who has just sipped from their finger bowl next to them or made another faux pas, letting that be a tool of, you know, division and making them feel inflating their own sense of self-righteousness, a civil person might, you know, choose to ignore it, or they might even go a step further. It's really uncomfortable taking them aside and quietly saying, hey, by the way, you know, you made this small error, don't worry about it, no one noticed it, but, you know, just don't want you to make this mistake in the future. That might be the even more courteous thing to do. Again, risky, right? Like somebody, maybe if you don't know them, calling them out, showing them they've made a mistake in a social setting. But I think that, you know, the obviously actually kind thing to do, you know, preventing them from making a mistake in the future. And I learned this from my mother. So my mother is something of an etiquette expert. She's called Judy the manners lady. And, you know, she's traveled the world for my entire life teaching manners, customer service protocols and etiquette to, you know, heads of state, customer to big companies. And is someone who cares deeply in the rules of politeness to the extent that they facilitate human relationship and friendship and human flourishing. But she's also the very first to kind of deviate from norms of propriety when they don't serve that end. And I'll give you a funny example. She loves languages. My mother is like an utter polyglot. She just collects languages wherever she goes. She's very well traveled. And I think today she can, you know, greet people and have like a very rudimentary conversation, like 48 languages, okay? And what's funny is that she will see someone and profile them in a way that is very non-PC. She'll be like, okay, like, I think I know where this person's from. I think I've been there. You know, they look like other people I know from this part of the world. And she'll spontaneously speak the language that she thinks that they speak. So kumusta ka in Tagalog, you know, when she sees someone she thinks it is a Filipino person. That's totally non-PC to profile someone and to assume that you think that you know their race and their ethnicity and everything about them. But when people hear this like tall, blonde, beautiful woman, you know, speak their home tongue, and often they're the minority in a culturally Caucasian environment, they light up. They just like utterly illuminate. Like she breaks this very conventional like rule of propriety, which is like don't profile people. But for the greater good of like fostering friendship and community. And like we've been invited over to, you know, so many people's homes and has so many like, you know, international feasts because she just collects languages and friends wherever she goes, like by doing this very, you know, unconventional, very bizarre, funny thing. It's just quirky, but it's her. Like she just like collects people and just is passionate about the human social project and is great at just building community wherever she goes, even if it means breaking the rules of etiquette and politeness to do so.
That's very interesting. By the way, I, growing up in Germany, heard the exact same story about Otto von Bismarck.
I love it. I love it. And Eleanor Roosevelt has been another protagonist. That's great.
So it's not only women, apparently. In some stories, it's men.
That's interesting. I'm a big Bismarck fan, but I've never heard that story about Bismarck. I didn't really peg him as like the decorous, hospitable type even, kind of a more curmudgeon-like.
No, I guess not. And I feel like he might well have enjoyed showing up for faux pas and getting some kind of diplomatic advantage out of it. So who knows whether this ever happened or who did that. I certainly like the distinction between a rigid adherence to the rules and sort of acting with a broader goal of connecting to people in this case, right, of making people feel comfortable. I suppose I would distinguish between two different circumstances here, right? I mean, one is a rule that actually may just be an erroneous rule, right? I think that we've sort of taken the basic insight that Asian Americans in particular often suffer what I suppose people would call microaggressions when people say, where are you from? And they say, you know, LA. And you say, where are you really from? I completely understand that that would be very alienating, right? Because you're an American, you're born in America, you feel American, and people, you know, probably often of a certain generation keep making you feel like you're not truly from this country, right? But I think we've overgeneralized that to, you know, if you're sitting in an Uber and an Uber driver has an audible accent, you can't ask where they're from. And I'm sure that can get annoying to Uber drivers as well, but I do often ask, Uber drivers where we're from, when I can hear they have an accent. And 9 times out of 10, they're very happy to engage in conversation about the place they're from. And obviously, if they realize that you know a little bit more about that place than the average passenger, then they're all the more interested in talking to you about it. And I've had sort of long political monologues from people from Persia, from Azerbaijan, from Ghana, from Ethiopia, telling me about what they see as their country's politics when I sort of, you know, elicit a little bit of interest. So there, I think there are rules of politeness that haven't stood the test of time, but I think actually are just impeding of genuine human connection.
The historical record supports exactly what you're saying. Like I read hundreds, if not thousands, of these conduct manuals from across history and across culture, and found, as part of researching for this book, and found exactly to your point that the rules of politeness are highly changeable. They're changeable between classes and across time as well. Like it's according to tastes and preferences, right? And of course, the trend is that the moment the out-group learns the norms, the in-group has to change the norms in order to stay the in-group, right? And there are so many fun stories from history that I could tell you to illuminate this. But that the principles of civility are the principles that modulate, temper our self-love and the worst excesses of our selfishness and help us consider the needs of others alongside of ourselves. They're remarkably timeless. People have independently come to similar assessments about what works when it comes to human flourishing and genuine human relationship and cooperation and collaboration, and what doesn't. And that is remarkable and fascinating to me. Sometimes there is this like kind of intellectual lineage and you know, people reading one another and you know, there's this influence over time. But often, like I, you know, from ancient China to ancient Arabia to ancient Sumeria, I read these texts and people just, to ancient Egypt, like I start my chapter 2 with the oldest book in the world, which is a civility book given to us from ancient Egypt, 2350 BC. And a lot of these maxims from Tahotep could appear in a Judith Martin Miss Manners column today in the Washington Post. They're just remarkably timeless, conventional wisdom about how to do life together. Like, don't gossip. Don't just be good to your friends when you need something. So that is, I just want to affirm exactly what you were intuiting really quickly.
So in terms of the different contingent norms, they obviously change a lot. And you know, when we're talking about books of manners, one of the points that I always remember from studying history is that often books of manners don't show us historically what a society didn't do, they show us what a society did, right? If you have a medieval book of manners that says, you know, really it's impolite to burp and fart at the table, you might think, well, this is a society like ours in which people didn't burp and fart at the table. But actually, if you wrote a manners book today, you wouldn't particularly emphasize this because you'd assume that people are not going to burp and fart at the table, right? And so actually, this indicates that in that society, people may well commonly have burped and farted at the table, which indeed for some time in certain societies in medieval Europe was a form of appreciation for your host or whatever. Now, this is no longer what we do, right? And we're saying it because, in fact, people are doing it. It reminds me of a completely different story that is burned into my memory. In my first year of graduate school, when I was doing my PhD at Harvard, I lived in graduate student dorms. And the Graduate Student Association put under everybody's door, I promise you, not just my door, a guide to bathroom etiquette, which contained the unpleasant and amazing sentence, "It is not customary in the United States to defecate in the showers."
Right. Why do they need to feel the need to put that in? Because someone had done it, right?
Right. And it also was sort of subtly, sort of in the United States, was kind of a weird subtle indication that they assumed this must have been an international student, which is a little odd. And then, of course, the idea that somebody would be sufficiently alien to the norms of the United States that before it's fine to take a shit in the shower, but at the same time sufficiently master the English language that they would understand the phrasing. And I remember this phrasing word for word. "It is not customary in the United States to defecate in the showers." I mean, it's really a beautiful document. But when do you think certain forms of politeness actually are lubricating of social interaction in the right way, right? I mean, I am somebody who grew up with immigrant parents in Germany and then went to university in England, which actually has very different social norms than Germany, and then came to the United States. And I often admire a certain set of social rules that can lubricate and facilitate social interaction. knowing how to be polite to each other, knowing how to interact, knowing, you know, how not to offend somebody, you know, having a kind of shared sense of norms about how to act in a certain kind of situation, perhaps especially difficult situations, it can actually be helpful as a kind of social lubricant. And I noticed when I was in France a few months ago, there's this kind of strange bourgeois theater play that people act out in a Parisian cafe house, right? Monsieur, votre table, you know, there's a certain kind of way of dealing with each other that's a very specific social script. Now, I think often people in France, and particularly in Paris, can be very rude to people who don't understand and know the script because they're not from there, and that's certainly something that I don't welcome. But for people who are part of that culture, there is something actually quite pleasant about the script. It does lubricate social interaction, does make it quite pleasant. So is there sort of so what ultimately, I guess, is your view of your mother's work or of Miss Manners type things? Does it have its place? It's just that we have to know when to deviate from it, or, you know, how should we think about it?
It's a great question. And I love that you use the word script, because I think that's really important. I love etymology. I love the origin and stories behind our language. I think it's always illuminating. And I love not just in English, not just our own language, but in other languages as well. And, you know, in my chapter on communication and technology, I unpack the etymological link between community and communication. They both come from the same etymological root, communis. And I think what's interesting about that, like, manners are a form of communication. They're nonverbal communication. And I think that just as when you go, you're a cultural minority, it behooves you to learn the language, the verbal language of the dominant culture, just to help you survive and to enjoy it more, right? That's why visiting France is my favorite country in the world, because I just have a very rudimentary, but, you know, a little bit of a language barrier, a basis, right, basis in language that gives me just that enhanced appreciation for it that I don't have in other parts of the world. And that just as it behooves us to learn the verbal language, just a few words to show respect for the dominant culture. Same with the social norms, you know, it behooves us to adapt to and not just, you know, walk in like the ugly American and assume that the whole world should, you know, conform to our sense of justice and right and propriety. And that's like the way to, you know, make an enemy in a country. But I mean, of course, the limit to that would be, does the dominant culture expect you to, and I think, you know, invoking Dr. King's litmus test between just and unjust law, just and unjust social norm. Is there a customary norm to treat a certain subsection of humanity with a little less decency, you know, to not respect all humans equally? Like, you know, you kind of can pick up these different things in part of the world that you can choose, you know, that's a part of this custom and culture I'm going to reject or, you know, not partake in. But I think otherwise, you're right that there's nothing inherently morally superior in the voodoo distinction, right? Like that a language like French, another language, I think in German as well, there is a formal you that you use for strangers and for new people, and a more intimate one, the two that you use with families and intimate, right? There's and in English, you know, even though we used to have that and you and thou, we don't have that anymore. We treat everyone's equal, right? We're all you now. But there's nothing inherently, you know, morally superior in that, but we do that because it's just a way to form and communicate respect where you are and in the language that you're in. We do that verbally. We learn the rules, the grammar of the language. And we also ought to learn the grammar of one's conduct as well when we're in a new part of the world as well. So, you know, it doesn't do anyone a service to just walk in and expect, you know, the world to speak our language in norms or verbally. That it behooves us, I think, that's what civility requires, is to make that effort, you know, not just assume everyone's going to adapt to us, but actually adapt to others as well when the situation requires it, especially if it means we're going to have, you know, greater chance of community and flourishing and a novel experience and context.
This is a little bit of a tangent, but I found myself, as you're speaking, reflecting about my experience of traveling in Japan a year ago. I've been to Japan a couple of times, and I greatly enjoyed it. It's really, you know, an amazing civilization. But I do think it is the country that I've been to in the world that has the greatest ability to impose social norms on its population. Now, I think Western societies have historically been able to do that in certain circumstances as well. For me, the closest equivalent in a certain kind of way to this stringency of Japanese social norms is what you can observe in Downton Abbey or some kind of past aristocratic set of social norms in the United Kingdom. I suppose you mentioned Queen Victoria earlier, right? I mean, what you might have experienced at the court of Queen Victoria. But in England, I think that only ever applied at most to about, you know, 1 or 2% of a society. And you know, outside a pub on a Friday night, I think you would always have seen mayhem in London. And what's sort of impressive in Japan is that the society has managed to take a similar set of social norms and apply to 95% of the population. And I guess there you see this sort of double impact where on the one side, it makes the country incredibly safe. It means that, you know, you can arrive there as a tourist and people are very helpful. You in certain ways feel very welcome to the society. You can see the depth of social cohesion in the country, right? And at the same time, it just can become incredibly oppressive. I started to feel oppressed after 2 weeks in the country by sort of how strong the social norms are. But I know that many Japanese people do as well. I mean, when I was there promoting a book, I was really struck that, you know, I was interviewed by a series of former foreign correspondents because they tend to be the only ones who spoke English well enough to interview a visiting author. And 4 or 5 different people, independently of each other, at the end of an interview said, "Dr. Mung-san, may I tell you something personal?" And I'd always say, "Sure, of course." And I was like, what on earth are we going to say? And we say, "I've been back in Tokyo for 2 years or 4 years or 3 years or however long it was in each of our cases. I can't do it anymore. I need to leave." And when I ask why, they say, you know, once you're outside of this stringent set of social norms, reintegrating into it and the expectations of how you work and how you dress your superior and so on just become incredibly oppressive. It becomes very, very hard to sustain them. So I do think that sort of social norms have this ambivalent nature where they facilitate social interactions, but they also bind us.
Well, this is exact same that language is. Like our verbal language, there's a duality to it, right? It can either unite or divide. We can use our words to uplift and build up and foster community relationship, human flourishing. Or as we see all too often in our world today, from our public leaders to social media, words can be vicious and they can be used to take down and tear down and destroy people and destroy community. So can our actions, right? So can our do. And, you know, you're a fan of John Stuart Mill just as I am. And right, in Mill's On Liberty, he was more concerned not of institutional threats to liberty and human flourishing and a vibrant expression of the diversity of human personality. He was not concerned about, you know, regime. He was concerned about social norms. He was concerned about the tightness and rigidity of his Victorian England, right? That he called, talk about constricting, he called it analogous, it did to the human soul, what Chinese foot binding did to the foot. It maimed and deformed it. And it's interesting because there are some scholars of international protocol. I forget the author, but I read her book and I found myself disagreeing with it. It's called Rule Makers, Rule Breakers. And it has this theory that, you know, some cultures are tight, like Japan, and some cultures like America and Western cultures are loose, right? And I kind of found myself kind of critical of that, like, broad categorization. I think at a surface level, you can talk about your experience in Japan and compare it to your experience in the West and maybe have that assumption. But I really think that cultures are just, they're tight about different things. You know, in Japan, it's maybe about formality of ritual and how you defer to your superiors. But in America, you can do whatever the heck you want unless you have the wrong opinion on climate or gender or race, right? Then you're destroyed. You know, it just depends. Every culture, I think, has their sacred cows, right? And even if we pretend give lip service to freedom and liberty and, you know, you do you and I do me, like, we don't actually mean that. We all have certain limits. We just draw them at certain places.
What I've just realized is that we're talking about the left's attitude towards civility and their misreading of civility as mere social rules and norms of politeness. And then the claim that those often stand in the way of a pursuit of true justice. I think, ironically, you could argue that in many progressive spaces in the last years, they have actually come very quickly to align on a set of quite rigid rules of politeness. If you say, you know, certainly, I mean, to use an example that sounds extreme, right? I mean, to say people of color is politically de rigueur, you know, even if a 70-80-year-old who's a little bit of confused would mistakenly talk about colored people, that would certainly could cost them a job or could make them a social pariah. Even if they say, oh my God, I'm sorry, I actually meant people of color, I misspoke, right? No, no, you broke this convention of how to refer in the right way to a group of people and how not to refer to a group of people. And we're going to enforce that as rigidly as many societies that one would, you know, classically have described as more non-Western or whatever, right? So there is actually a strange way in which some of the sort of moral panic of the last years has taken the form of a new set of rule of manners. And that explains part of the broad-based resentment against it, right? I think people have always had resentment against aristocrats who said, you know, you're up there in your castle and you have the right way to pass the port. And if ever I was invited to appear in your company, and by and large you tried to keep me away, and I wouldn't know which way to pass the port, you would, you know, laugh to each other about me and then expel me. And I think that actually that oddly gets at the nature of some of the anger against social elites today, where they're saying, look, you know, you go to your graduate seminars and you learn exactly how to speak about certain topics and which terms to use and why the term that was the one that I was taught to use to be polite 5 years ago is now suddenly no longer a term that anybody should use. And then if I make the mistake, you laugh at me and throw me back out into the realm of the plebs. And so actually, oddly, that helps to explain a similarity in the nature of resentment.
And relatedly, you know, in this attempt to be inclusive, right? They end up being divisive and exclusive often of the people that they're trying to include, who aren't just, they haven't had the educational opportunities, haven't read the right newspapers, haven't trafficked to the right circles to know what the appropriate term of the day to refer to themselves or other minorities is. And they find themselves left out. They're like, what? And they're, you know, vilified and condemned. And so it's just a really interesting phenomenon and inherent kind of tension and contradiction. You know, Pierre Bourdieu, the French sociologist, he had this concept that was really influential on me, and it is throughout my book, called habitus. Habitus was this cultural acclimation, tastes and norms and preferences and just kind of institutional knowledge from being raised in a certain environment that was actually hard to just kind of teach overnight in a crash course. And there's a kind of latter day Pierre Bourdieu, just someone who's also a student of him like I am, who studies this phenomenon of habitus on elite college campuses. His name is Anthony Abraham Jack, an African-American professor who studies what he calls the privileged poor, the people, that's a body of his work and his book that came out on this topic. And he talks about how there are kind of two types of underprivileged people who come to elite academic environments. One are the privileged poor, those that they're from very disadvantaged backgrounds, but they have found themselves on scholarships to elite high schools or prep schools or boarding schools. And that gave them a slight advantage. You know, it inculcated them to a certain extent, the habitus necessary to arrive at Harvard on day one as a freshman and know how to navigate this new environment, you know, how to talk to authority figures, how to talk to your peers, how to behave in class, what the right brands are, what to wear, right? Like the right, where to vacation, where to holiday, how to talk about wines, you know, like that they weren't born to that, but they had socialization and this habitus that gave them an advantage when they find themselves in this new environment. And then there's another category that he calls the doubly disadvantaged. And these are the ones that, you know, don't end up, they go to public high school, they don't get the scholarships, the fancy schools, and they find themselves like a fish out of water on day one at Harvard or Emory or some of these other kind of elite institutions where they're like, I don't know what to do. Like, how do I ask for help? How do I cultivate a mentor? Like, what is even an office hour? Like, you know, their friends. The argument he makes is that academic life is inherently social, and they find themselves at a disadvantage communicating through the norms, the cultural habits and mores of these new environments. And that is a necessary barrier in how they're able to express their innate, you know, academic potential. And so much potential goes unrealized because of this inordinate emphasis on these certain norms and rituals and practices and what I would call politeness, right? Like these external things, like, you know, wearing the right brands, saying the right things, holidaying the right place. Like those are matters of taste and preferences, complying with the rules of etiquette that I argue, and this is also what he argues in his book, we need to, in academic settings, make those things matter less and instead focus on things that actually help people deploy who they really are and bring forth their true self and true potential in academic settings. Like, and I think it just maps on really well too. And I've really, you know, enjoyed learning from his work and research because it maps on well to the argument I'm making about, you know, get away from the trappings, you know, leave those behind and focus on, you know, the disposition, the motivation behind someone's heart and action.
That's very interesting. He was actually a contemporary of mine at Harvard, I believe. But I haven't read his book, so I should do that and perhaps get him on the podcast. So let's go to some of his more timeless principles. If you're saying, obviously, sort of which way to pass a port is the kind of thing that's going to be different from society to society. Table manners. Each society has a pretty stringent set of table manners, perhaps some more stringent than others. But each society has things that are going to offend people if you do them while you're eating. But they're going to differ from place to place. What are the things where, as you're going through these different works, you found you were recognizing again and again? What are the things that surpass these kind of contingent norms and are principles that you think we should take to heart and perhaps could learn from in the United States today?
Yeah. So, you know, let's go back to Tahotep for a second. He's, you know, he's this advisor to the pharaoh in ancient Egypt, lived 2350 BC, so over 4,000 years ago. And he was actually offered the position of becoming pharaoh, which he turned down in order to lead a more quiet life in the pastures. And after he had reached, you know, the pinnacle of political and worldly success, he withdrew from public life and just set pen to paper and wanted to distill and immortalize the timeless principles of human flourishing, of living well with others that he had derived from experience and observation being in the pinnacles of political and temporal power. And so he wrote this book for Pharaoh's son, intending and hopes that Pharaoh's son would read it and become a wise and just ruler himself. And, you know, it's amazing how timeless so many of these 37 maxims written 4 millennia ago are. You know, he says, like, don't, in the heat of the moment, let the anger in an argument get the best of you, right? But that's, you know, we're still seeing that on social media all the time. We go on and we're triggered. We're like, oh, you know, like, but of course, no one's ever had their mind changed or been persuaded on Twitter. That's not what people go there to do. Or he says, you know, do not abuse a power differential. If you have authority over someone, be good and generous and gracious to those that are vulnerable in society. Don't harm them. Don't exploit that power differential. And just like other, you know, don't lie, don't slander, you know, honor the gods. These are things that you see recur time and time again. And in addition to some, you know, context-specific, you know, mandates and maxims for the good life. For example, you know, very enlightened for this time, he says, don't beat your wife. You know, he's like, be good and generous to your wife and she'll be a flower that blossoms and bring you a lot of joy, you know, like, so that was like context specific, but a lot of it is timeless, right? I think that is a timeless argument. Don't beat your wife. It's generally, you know, good advice that has stood the test of time.
Probably, again, as with the less important table manners, an indication of what was standard in the society, right? I mean, nowadays, our laws rightly say don't beat your wife, but our books of manners probably would not, because that would be an assumed piece of knowledge.
And this is exactly my argument that, you know, human nature doesn't change. The human condition is the same as it is today, as it was 2350 BC in the first man, that we are defined by two competing forces, love of others and love of self. We become fully human in relationship and community. We're more likely to survive and thrive in cooperative collaboration with others. And yet morally and biologically, we're driven to meet our own needs before others. And those two facets are indelible parts of who we are and their intention, that the self-love as part of who we are will always and always has been and always will be this perennial threat to to the joint project of living well and flourishing with others. And, you know, to exactly to your point, people have independently observed the human condition, saw this, and come to similar assessments, reminding people to restrain the worst parts of themselves, restrain a, you know, single-minded pursuit of their own interests and desires, restrain that for the sake of a greater good, which is flourishing and living in community and friendship with others. And to exactly to your point, and again, it seems like every decade or so, someone in our own era rises up. Every generation needs their own Tahotep, right? To rise up and remind people of this timeless, you know, body of wisdom. Why? To your point, because they're not following it, right? No one's going to take the time to write a diatribe if everyone of the day is doing what they're supposed to do. Another example that I love is Erasmus of Rotterdam. And Erasmus is the protagonist. He's a protagonist of civility in my book, but also in a book that I'd love to discuss with you because I think it's really compatible with your interest in work, Norbert Elias's Civility and Power and Civility and Civilization is a series of books that I think that you'd enjoy and I'd love to talk with you about. But Erasmus, you know, was this genius, this intellectual superstar of the European Renaissance, never spent more than 2 years of his life in any one place because he was just this coveted dinner party guest and tutor. And he just traveled from court to court across Europe and just this peripatetic scholar that was just universally beloved because he was jovial and kind. And yet one day he's out and about and he thinks a youth insufficiently treats him with insufficient deference, doesn't greet him appropriate to to whatever his standard of the day is. And he goes, "That's it. Society's going to hell in a handbasket. I'm going to write a book on manners." And he does. And it becomes this like international sensation that, you know, basically never goes out of print for the next like 400 years in European history. And it's translated into every European language within a decade. This is like, you know, remarkable for the 1500s, like with the printing press is still novel technology. And I mean, talk about the timelessness of complaining about kids these days, right? Like our mutual friend, Jonathan Haidt, just came out with The Anxious Generation yesterday, right? Which is like, you know, it's not just complaining about kids these days and how they're using technology. It also offers really productive, you know, ways to help them.
And to be fair to John, his complaint about the kids these days is not that they don't have manners and aren't sufficiently polite, but that rates of mental illness has spiked.
They are stunted socially, though. That is, yeah, you've read his book too. They are like socially stunted because they're on all their communication is digitally mediated. But I mean, we all know the cranky curmudgeon, right? That is complaining about the youths, you know, not having sufficient deference. That's timeless. Literally, it's always been thus.
And it's because, in fact, you know, as you come to be older, 18-year-olds never pay enough deference to you. That has always been true, and it will continue to be true till the end of history. What is it, you know, I think that I have a listenership on this podcast that comes to these conversations because they want to hear people talk about subjects that interest them, but also to disagree in a civil manner, right? So I do think that you have an audience here that is predisposed to like your argument. And of course, Persuasion, the magazine that I founded, is trying to show what it is to have serious disagreements about important topics from within a broadly philosophical liberal perspective in a way that is productive and constructive. What is it that people who are broadly speaking on board with your project still do wrong? And what is it that you think perhaps all of us can learn from your reading and writing? How is it that we can actually live up to the sort of broad goal of civility that I'm going to speak for my audience? I think most of the people listening to this podcast do share. How is it that we can actually put that into practice better than perhaps we tend to do? And perhaps if you have an example, where do you see yourself falling short of the virtue of civility and have to work on yourself to be more civil in the right ways?
I mean, that's the inherent vulnerability in writing a book on civility, that I myself am imperfect and fall short of my own ideals that I articulate and argue for throughout the book countless times a day. You know, like my home was destroyed in a flood last year and I'm the general contractor on the restoration and I, you know, I want to throttle my contractors for like not showing up, not doing their job, right? Like I'm a mother, I lose my patience with my kids. Like, and like life can often feel like death by 1,000 paper cuts, where it's just like aggravation, low-grade aggravation after low-grade aggravation. I'll give you an example. Like I went to my gym class yesterday or a few days ago, and I showed up 1 minute late. And there's literally two other people in the class. The instructor didn't want to let me in. And I'm like, I am 14 weeks pregnant. I am so sick. I have two babies. Like, you have no idea how hard and like complicated my life is right now. It is a miracle I'm here at all. And you're not going to let me work out because I'm 1 minute late. Like, what? Like, my mind just exploded and I was livid. And I immediately like got on the phone with my friend who owns the gym. And like, I just like lost it. Like, I totally lost my cool. And like, it became this whole thing. And I, you know, so this is the reality of this problem. You know, we are very quick. It's a fundamental attribution error, right, in psychology. Like, we know our own stories very well. I know all of my excuses all too well for why I was 1 minute late, right? And so we want people to tell stories of exoneration about us and our behavior, right? But when it comes to other people, we want to judge them by just their standards, right? From her perspective, I was 1 minute late, and we have rules and protocols. And like, you know, I'm someone who doesn't like rules. I'm constitutionally allergic to authority. Like, all the rules my mother educated me in growing up, I was like, why do we do things the way we do them? Why do we shake hands and not bow? Why are we setting the table with forks here, knives here, and not using chopsticks or our hands like other cultures? Like, I just like, you know, I wanted to like hunger for why. And, you know, part of me in that moment when she wouldn't let me in. I read a lot of Max Weber after I left government service. We didn't have a chance to talk about my government service. That's part of why I wrote this book. Like, I experienced viscerally the division in our world when I served in federal government and like wanted, I didn't feel like I was being part of the solution, and I yearned to be, which is why I left and wrote a book on how to peacefully coexist across deep difference, which I saw not happening when I was in Washington, D.C. And so just like this is a timeless problem that is always going to be a part of our lives. And like, you know, I had to just show grace to her, show grace to myself. I still owe her an apology. Like I'm very much a work in progress, and I don't have it figured out, and I never will. Like, this is, again, a core message of the book, that there is no single public figure, no single technology, no single epiphenomenon that is the cause of this. Like, we are the cause. This is a part of the human condition, a part of the human personality that we all share. And similarly, there is no silver bullet, right? The moment Donald Trump leaves, this isn't going to go away. If Elon Musk and Twitter suddenly disappeared, right? Like, the human condition is still going to be the human condition, right? That change really begins and ends with us, like, and how we choose to, you know, interact with each other every day. And like, we're going to fall short, and we just have to resolve to do better, right? And we just have to, we're so ruthless. We're so exacting with others today. And we, you know, we want to define people by one aspect of who they are, and not take like a full view of like the dignity and personhood of the other. I have this idea in the book called unbundling people, like seeing the part, the mistake, and light of the whole, the dignity and worth of the human being. So, I mean, to answer your question, how do we start? How do we begin? Like, we temper our expectations, really. My whole book is a long essay, way too long. When I was reading my audiobook, I was like, why did I write such a long book? It's way too long, but it's like a 400-page essay on tempering our expectations, you know, when it comes to this problem. Like, this is a timeless, intractable problem. No simple causes, no simple solutions. Temper our expectations for ourselves and others. And I'll just leave with Erasmus. What can we do in our everyday? Erasmus ends his lovely book called A Handbook for Civility in Children. He says, readily ignore the faults of others and avoid falling short yourself. That is what he says is like the wellspring of true civility and human harmony and flourishing. And what's interesting is, and I know I struggle with this myself, the inverse is all too easy and all too common, right? Blame others and then exonerate ourselves. But he says, no, invert that. Readily ignore the faults of others, you know, tell these stories of exoneration and then avoid committing social infractions and making my life more difficult for others. Like, don't be 1 minute late for gym class. Just show up on time.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Yasha, for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to The Good Fight. Lots of listeners have been spreading the word about the show. If you too have been enjoying the podcast, please be liked, rate the show on iTunes, tell your friends all about it, share it on Facebook or Twitter. And finally, please mail suggestions for great guests or comments about the show to goodfightpod@gmail.com. That's goodfightpod@gmail.com.
This recording carries a Creative Commons 4.0 international license. Thanks to Silent Partner for their song, Chess Pieces.